So should we start with the bartender?
You mean Tom Wilhelmsen, the Mariner reliever?
Yeah, well, we'll introduce Tom in a second, but let me introduce you first. This is Art Thiel, KPLU's sports maven and editor and founder of Sports Press Northwest. So who is the bartender?
The bartender is Tom Wilhelmsen, 31, an important member of the Mariners bullpen, which was the best in baseball last year.
Fastball.
Struck him out. Got him. Hey now, as Tom Wilhelmsen gets the Mariners out of eighth inning trouble.
So where did he come from? What was his journey?
He grew up in Tucson, Arizona, a very successful athlete, and was drafted in the seventh round by the Milwaukee Brewers, whose scouting director was Jack Cerenzik, a guy who would play a role in his future. He became very successful, but after a season in the minor leagues in 2003, he was caught for a second time with a positive test for smoking dope. The Brewers said goodbye, and Tom said, you know what? I'm tired of baseball. I'm out of here. And so for 7 years, he basically wandered the earth. He spent several years hiking, and then he went to Europe and was gone for a couple of years with his girlfriend, who became his wife. And he was having a great time. Every time he returned to the U.S., he would bartend.
So kind of living what a lot of people would consider the good life, it sounds like.
It sounds like that would be a great life for most of us, and some of us did indulge that in our 20s. But Tom decided, you know what? I think I need to do something more. And he got his itch back for baseball in 2010.
And this is after not even having picked up a baseball in years and years.
Right. He was done being an athlete. He was a smoker of cigarettes as well as other herbs. But it didn't go away. It just was sublimated until Jack Cerenzik, who became the general manager of the Seattle Mariners, said, want to try this? And they signed him to a contract. He worked out in the minors. And for the last 3 years, he's been a very successful major league pitcher.
How rare or common is it for somebody to take so much time off and do so many non-sports related activities and then come back to a serious major league career?
Almost unheard of. To leave for 7 years and pick up where you left off is just remarkable, and it's a great story of redemption.
Yeah, and these stories of redemption, I mean, why do you suppose it is we're so drawn to these stories of second chances in sports?
It's part of the American psyche. It's part of our ethos. America is a nation of second chances. We take it for granted, but if you talk to people from around the world, the single thing they admire most in America and Americans is the capacity for reinvention.
Yeah, it's one of these stories that plays out again and again in that quintessential American psychodrama that is professional sports, but it also plays out in daily life in a million different ways. Well, this week on Sound Effect, we bring you tales of second chances from right here in our part of the world. So, Art, I'm going to say thanks to you and see you around next time.
My pleasure.
All right, up next, we'll get to our stories of second chances right after we invite a few friends over to break down the news of the week. So stick around for that. Well, here we are at the end of another week, so it's time now to hit the highlights of the week's news with our distinguished guests. And this week, we have Anna Menard, who is a former City Hall reporter for The Stranger and currently an organizer for Working Washington. Jonathan Cunningham is a contributor to City Arts Magazine and the former editor of Flip the Media. And Lauren Foster is assistant editor of South Sound Magazine and 425 Magazine. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Sound Effect.
Morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
So in a couple of minutes, we are going to get your nominations for Overreported Story of the Week and Underreported Story of the Week. But first off, this week's top story, it's got to be Bertha. You know, our friend Bertha, the tunnel boring machine who's been on ice for more than a year underneath downtown Seattle, has now finally poked her head out into the access pit that was built to rescue her. So, Anna Menard, what do you think? Are our troubles over? Is this it?
Yeah, everything's fine now.
Sweet. All right.
Yeah, Bertha moved, 20 feet? So, woohoo!
So, what do you make of the progress this week? I mean, how big of a deal is this little chapter in the great, great story of Bertha?
I was actually surprised by how excited everyone was. There was a helicopter that was, shooting live video and live streaming online, circling downtown for hours and hours. And all it was showing was some dust spitting out of the pit. You couldn't even see anything. So I'm
in
glad.
In their defense, there has been nothing going on there for a really long time. So
yes.
This must seem like live action, full-on adrenaline to them.
I guess. I think because I'm kind of cynical about Bertha in general and because it's been such a boondoggle so far, the fact that it could move into that pit was maybe less impressive to me than I guess it was to the helicopter news. I was really amused by the helicopter coverage because it just seemed like, cool, more dust. Yep, more dust. Oh, they're hosing it down now. Yep, nothing's really happening.
Jonathan Cunningham, what did you make of Bertha's progress this week?
I also thought that it was a bit overblown. It's a bit of an embarrassment, the entire project, in my opinion. And it's also not a surprise that something that large would have an issue and be stuck. And something of that size, if there's an issue, it's going to take quite a while to fix. So I'm not surprised by that. But it seems a little bit like saving face. I mean, this thing hasn't moved in so long that press releases regarding movement by foot, whoever has to hit send on those press releases has got to feel awfully embarrassed.
Yeah, well, I think they're used to sort of withholding their press releases until 4 or 5 in the afternoon on Friday, so they don't get a lot of attention. This week they had something to crow about. Lauren Foster, some good news for Bertha after a long string of setbacks. What did you think about it?
I definitely think Bertha is making some headway, but I think she has quite a journey to come. And even getting her to this point, she's got a long road ahead of her and one that probably involves quite a few lawsuits. So,
yeah, exactly. I mean, I think of this whole thing kind of as a prelude to the real action, which is, of course, the years of litigation that will follow. I wonder, Anna, there's been a lot of schadenfreude, perhaps, as Bertha has been struggling. And I wouldn't sort of lump you in with that camp exactly, but you've definitely been a skeptic of the deep bore tunnel. So, like, how do you take news like this? Do you just sort of watch with detached amusement?
I live here and I want things to be successful, so I don't want us to have wasted billions of dollars on a giant piece of garbage that does nothing. So I really want it to work on some level. I just think even if it goes really smoothly and everything from here on out is wonderful, all we get is 2 miles of freeway for not that many cars.
How do you see these days the argument about the waterfront, you know, the Bertha project, the tunnel project being essential to bring down the viaduct and connect the waterfront to downtown? I mean, is that something that is still on people's minds? Are people still talking about it? Or are we just so caught up in the tunneling boondoggle? What do you think, Jonathan Cunningham?
Well, I think it depends on where you are and what your interests are. I mean, I think for a lot of the businesses that are there, if you have business interests that are tied to the waterfront, the viaduct, I think it's something that's very pressing and that you have high hopes that this is going to do exactly what they said it would. There's just a lot of other things going on. And depending on where you are in this very large and vast city, South Seattle, you know, you have less concern. This is always going to be a story until this project is completed. And as you say, for quite a while after this project is completed, this is going to be a big deal. And we're sort of stuck with it. So I think all Seattleites, especially because so many of us are obviously as taxpayers, we have to pay for it. We are stuck with this. And it's something that we do think about. But on a daily basis, not so much, especially with given the inactivity of Bertha. I hadn't thought about Bertha in quite a while. And now it's just Bertha, 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 which is just a funny name to begin with. I'm also just not surprised. I mean, you know, when I think of Bertha, I think of like old and slow. You know, it's something that's not surprising.
Of course they named the terrible, terrible boondoggle machine after the first woman mayor. Thanks a lot, patriarchy.
I think it's funny because I feel like she's become, like, the machine itself has become kind of like this character in our city now. Like, she has her own Twitter account and you can tweet Bertha and she talks about her health on there and, you know, wishes the city a happy holidays. And it's funny that she's kind of become this almost person. People love to personify Bertha and how she's doing.
Yeah, although that Twitter account was conspicuously silent for quite a while.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. Well, that's our top story this week, the reemergence of Bertha. Now we're going to move on to our overreported stories of the week. And we'll start with your choice for overreported, Jonathan Cunningham.
To me, I mean, I'm reading a lot more about Marshawn Lynch and Marshawn Lynch's contract than I care to. We're still in the same month that they lost the Super Bowl. I think there's a little bit of like Seahawks fatigue. And, you know, I personally feel like, you know, if the Seahawks cared so much about Marshawn Lynch and how he felt in his contract, they should have given him the ball on the 1 yard line.
Oh,
you know, they did not. And thus, I don't really care what the GM has to say 3 weeks later about Marshawn Lynch, how we hope he comes back. If you wanted him to come back, you should have given him the ball on the 1 yard line.
All right. So the Seahawks making it their triumphant return is our overreported story of the week. Thanks for that, Jonathan Cunningham. And Lauren Foster, what's your overreported story of the week?
Mine is Seahawks related too. I thought that all the stories about Russell Wilson going to see 50 Shades of Grey was a little ridiculous.
Oh. You're combining two overreported stories in a beautiful overreported sandwich.
It's true. I just think it's so funny that became national news. What's the big deal? He went to see a movie that brought in, what, $80 million? He went with millions and millions of other Americans, and people were outraged about it, but of course they were. And I think there's this problem about celebrity news becoming, you know, too much of our own news.
And connect the dots if people haven't read those stories like me. Like, why are people outraged that Russell Wilson went to see this movie?
Well, Russell Wilson is, you know, a Christian, and there were other Christians who believe the movie is too raunchy and that, you know, as a role model, maybe he shouldn't be going to see 50 Shades of Grey.
I see. Gotcha. Okay. Well, there's your overreported story of the week, thanks to Lauren Foster. And Anna Menard, what is your choice for overreported story this week?
My overreported story this week was the war on cars, which is a phrase that I don't think should ever be in the news again, but it came up again when a few stories came out about parking in Seattle and how parking is vanishing and disappearing all over Seattle. I kind of get offended by that inflammatory language.
Is this kind of a Bill O'Reilly-style War on Christmas kind of a channeling that's happening with cars?
Yeah, I think it's just trying to stir people up because cars are this giant piece of personal property that we move around the city in and people feel really intensely about them. But parking is not vanishing and disappearing just because they like put in a couple of bike lanes and like made a couple little parklets in a parking spot. In all those stories about the war on parking and the war on cars, they mentioned that there's like 500,000 parking spaces in the city, which seems fine. I think parking's doing okay.
Okay. Well, thank you, Anna, for your overreported story of the week. Now, onward to our underreported stories of the week. What's the story that you saw this week that caught your attention that you would like to get a little bit more attention? Jonathan Cunningham?
Well, I saw that it was the Times that actually did a story on the fact that Franklin High School is doing away with their gendered graduation ceremony. Mm-hmm. So they previously would have the, you know, male and female graduates in different areas for as they graduate and in different colored gowns, which is something that is, you know, problematic in general, especially in 2015, and that would certainly be problematic for any students that are trans or identified as trans or somewhere in between, because there's a lot of in between, especially in Seattle in 2015. So I'm glad that they actually did away with it. There are several other schools that still have this tradition, but Franklin is doing away with that for this June, and I think that's something that more people should know about.
Well, thanks for that underreported story of the week. And Lauren Foster, what's your choice?
I found this story tucked away in the Tacoma News Tribune on Wednesday, and it's about this woman named Sandra Collins who was addicted to meth, and she was so addicted she would get clean just long enough to have her children, and she was in an abusive relationship, and things were not looking great for her, but she got this second chance, and the Goodwill gave her a job at an outlet store in Tacoma, and she worked her way up, and she's going to be the manager of the new Goodwill store in Olympia. And I love this story because it is about second chances. And it's not so much that I think the story is undercovered and is going to be hitting front pages in a couple of days, but more that I think this kind of subject gets underreported all the time.
It reveals the lenses that we sort of see the news through, and it excludes a lot of interesting stuff that's part of the experience of living here.
I think that's a very touching story. It's a common story. It's not common enough because these things do happen and people do recover, especially from addiction, drug addiction, alcoholism. People do recover. And it's good that a newspaper would take time to write that story. There aren't enough reporters that will actually go after that. And sometimes, quite often, there aren't enough editors that would approve a story like that.
All right. Great choice for underreported story of the week. And Anna Menard, what is your nominee?
For underreported story, I picked kind of an aspect of a story, which is that the city council is undergoing a lot of changes right now, as 3 of the 9 council members have said they're not going to seek re-election after our district election system was voted in last year, and they're going to have to be facing a new crop of candidates that are newly energized by that policy. So Sally Clark is the latest council member who announced this week she won't run for re-election. And while that was well covered by lots of people, I did not get to why that happened in a deeper way. I think a lot of people reported on the fact that she did and some analysis of what might have happened, what might have contributed. I really want to know what actually happened.
You want the dirt.
I do. I want someone to go find that gossip. I'm not in City Hall anymore, and I just want to know the gossip and the real story as opposed to some conspiracy theories that people are tossing around.
All right, 3 great choices for underreported story of the week. Thanks for bringing those into our panelists this week. Anna Menard, formerly of The Stranger and currently of Working Washington. Jonathan Cunningham, former editor of Flip the Media and a contributor to City Arts Magazine, and Lauren Foster, assistant editor of South Sound Magazine and 425 Magazine. Thank you all for coming on Sound Effect.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week's show is all about second chances. And when you think about a second chance, you often think about it as an opportunity to basically set everything right. You know, it's a cure-all. If only I could do it over again, then everything would be okay. But sometimes those second chances are not so easy. You know, sometimes they're actually a huge struggle. And we're going to tell you a story right now that's like that. It deals with a terrible crime and a man who was wrongly convicted of committing it. And we should warn you, there are some difficult subjects that are discussed in this. KPLU's Ed Ronka went to Yakima to bring us the tale.
Ted Bradford's second chance began about 5 years after he got out of prison. Hi, Ted.
Yes.
Ed.
Ed.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Thanks. We're at his apartment on a quiet street in Yakima.
I was telling Jolene, I was like, well, I hope he's not looking for like a, you know, like a happy story, because it's... You know, the sad part is, that, or sad truth is, it's not always, you know, that easy.
Jolene is his wife. They've been married for a couple years now. She's in photos on the wall, which is decorated like any wall in any apartment. But on a table at one end of the small living room, right near the kitchen, is something you won't find in any apartment. A silver frame containing a court document.
The jury, having found the defendant not guilty on all counts in the above case, now, therefore, it is hereby ordered that the defendant is acquitted on all charges filed in this case.
It's not a lot of words for kind of a big deal.
Right. It's a life-changing event, and that's why I have it framed, and it's in our living room on display.
Here's what happened. In September of 1995, a woman in Yakima was raped in her home. About 6 months later, police arrested Bradford on a different charge, actually, indecent exposure. But neighbors said they had seen a car like his driving in the neighborhood just before the rape occurred all those months ago. The police questioned Bradford and turned away an attorney sent by his wife. They said Bradford needed to request a lawyer himself. Hour after hour, they questioned Bradford, telling him that he was not leaving that room until he told the truth. After 9 hours, Bradford confessed. And he says that is the question he gets the most. Why would anyone confess to a crime they did not do?
They'll always say, well, I would never confess. Never. I don't care if they beat me. The only thing I could say is, well, you were not in that situation. You don't know how terrifying it was.
Bradford says the police told him they had DNA evidence that would prove he committed the crime.
I'm thinking, well, if they do test that, it's going to prove my innocence. So it doesn't matter what I tell them. If I give them this statement, you know, I'll be out of this situation.
But the DNA tests were inconclusive and could not prove his innocence. Still, there were other factors that might have given the jury some doubt. Bradford is much shorter than the attacker the victim described, and there's evidence that he was at work when the crime was committed. But still, the jury convicted him.
The confession evidence, I think, in their eyes, outweighed any alibi evidence.
At the time he was arrested, he had a stable job working at a wood products factory, no debt, a retirement plan, and was a married father of 2 young children, ages 1 and 2.
You know, I missed out on their first day of school, you know. So many firsts. I missed out on all those moments.
He would spend nearly a decade in prison.
And that's, you know, that's something that you can't get back.
Bradford eventually got help from attorneys at Innocence Project Northwest. It's part of the University of Washington Law School. They take cases from people who believe they've been wrongly convicted. In 2006, 10 years after his arrest and after he had already been released from prison, DNA evidence from the scene was tested again, and Bradford's conviction was overturned. Still, it would take another 4 years and a second trial before his name was completely cleared.
I hope you never have to experience what myself and other exonerees have gone through. Because, you know, it goes back to the people that ask me, well, why would you confess? I would never confess. Well, you were never in that situation. You don't know what it's like.
Bradford says he's thankful for the second chance that came with his exoneration, but it was not an instant return to the life he had before. The time between his release from prison and his exoneration was very difficult. He told employers that he'd been wrongly convicted, but the official documents still said otherwise. And then even after his record was clear, he had a job lined up, but he got sick.
The day I was supposed to go in to finalize everything, the night before is when I had this pancreatitis attack and was rushed to the emergency room.
So it's been hard. When a job application asks, for example, whether he's ever been convicted of a felony, he's legally allowed to check no on the form, but...
there's still the problem of the gap in work history. You gotta count the 10 years that I was gone, that I was locked up. No work history there.
He's still looking, if you know of anything.
Ted is a lovely human being. He is one of my favorite people.
That's Lara Zarosky, Policy Director for Innocence Project Northwest, the group responsible for Bradford's exoneration. In fact, Bradford was Washington's first exoneration based on DNA evidence. Zarosky says there's no way to know how many people are wrongly convicted without looking at every conviction that has ever occurred. Like, you know, ever. And that's impossible. So they focus on the cases they can. And they work to address the root causes of wrongful conviction. Things like faulty witness identifications and false confessions.
Really, what it would take for us to stop doing our work would be a wholesale reinvention of the criminal justice system.
When a client is exonerated, the attorney's hard work is over. But for the exoneree, it's often just the beginning.
Once the case is resolved, the person is still there and has to be put back together. And there are no resources out there to help that person build their life back. So they're really left on their own to try to make that happen.
Like Ted Bradford. He tried to reconcile with his first wife, but they had grown too far apart, he says. He's remarried now. Bradford's two children, who were babies when he went into prison, are now 19 and 21. And he's having some luck reconnecting with them.
It's been awesome. My daughter comes over all the time, and she'll come over for dinner, and... it's kind of funny because my wife says she's a jabberjaw just like me. But, you know, they're young adults. You know, now they're both out on their own. It's just the way life is. But, you know, people have their own lives to live, more or less. You know, I can't be selfish and hog them all to myself like I want to.
Missing out on their childhoods is one of the many things Bradford has worked to deal with in the years since his release from prison.
For a lot of years, I was angry. And, well, I still am it from time to time, but I deal with it more positively now.
Bradford keeps his guitar handy at home. He played a lot in prison and still plays in a band with other exonerees, including Alan Northrup, who served 17 years in Washington prisons for rape, kidnapping, and burglary before being cleared of the crimes by DNA evidence. They actually played together in prison, too, not knowing that the other one was also having his case re-examined.
You know, since I was a teenager, I've been playing guitar. And, you know, that's what gets you started to begin with, is that rock star, you know.
I want to grow up to be a rock star, play guitar in a band.
And so maybe this is my shot.
In the meantime, Ted Bradford just wants people to understand that wrongful convictions happen. And he wants people to know what happened to him. After all, Bradford says, one day most of us will be called for jury duty.
That was KPLU's Ed Ronco. He was talking with Ted Bradford, who was exonerated after serving nearly 10 years in prison for rape. And what you're hearing now is the song that Bradford wrote just a few months ago. You're listening to Sound Effect, and here is what Gordon Hempton is listening to.
So the first thing is when I get on location, and if it proves to be truly a quiet place where nature is at its most natural, I just listen. And that, to me, means take all the sounds in with equal value. I don't listen for anything.
Gordon Hempton is one of the country's foremost nature recordists, meaning he goes out into natural places and records the sounds, and then his recordings get used in movies and music and TV documentaries. He lives on the Kitsap Peninsula, and the guy's not just a nature lover. He is a connoisseur of the sounds of nature.
I remember standing there in the Belize forest, the rainforest down there, just listening to what I might hear, and then this bird comes along. And it's like, oh my God, that can really be a bird and sound so musical. It sounds like music. Why? I mean, it doesn't sing for our benefit, and that really uncovers that mysterious link of this is our home planet, we evolved here. And I like spending that time in that situation. So as I listen to myself sort of explain what it is that I'm excited about, yeah, this is my worship. When I push record, I feel like I'm a true listener.
The sounds of the natural world were sacred to him, and he's also their defender. He is an activist against noise pollution. But then something happened to Gordon Hempton one spring day in 2011.
I woke up, and I thought, well, this is kind of funny. It's April, and the sun is shining, the birds should be singing. And I was reminded of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. And I thought, well, is it happening in our neighborhood? Something the matter with the birds? So I leaned over to now my wife, then my partner, Kate. And I said, Kate, do you hear a bird song? And she goes, yes.
The sound tracker was losing his hearing. So he went to doctors, he went to specialists to try and get a diagnosis, and no one could come up with a good explanation for why his hearing was deserting him. And so he found himself on the clock. He was basically in a race to finish his life's work. His life's work is this giant multi-volume collection of nature recordings called Quiet Planet, and he was trying to get it done before he went completely deaf. He was afraid he wouldn't be able to. And he was even more afraid of losing human connections.
Well, how bad is this going to get? Already this puts me out of work, but am I going to lose touch entirely? And that's really my greatest fear, is that I'll lose touch with my family, loved ones around me, my sense of community. So much comes through our ears and into our being that we take for granted while we're being distracted by what we're looking at. You begin to get edgy, irritable. Just something as simple as having a conversation with a person became as special as what a dessert would be. And those moments in my day did disappear. Everything became a grind.
But then Hempton began to hear from other people who had lost their hearing, and he found an unexpected culprit. Could it be that the thing that had robbed the sound tracker of his hearing was allergies?
Was that something you were expecting?
Not at all. It's like allergies. I know I've had a few allergies in the past, but we're talking itchy eyes, stuffy nose. Well, as it turns out, allergies can affect the inner ears just as much as they affect any other part of the body. And so I went to an allergist at the end of a full day of testing. A big concern was that I was allergic to environmental substances like pollens and molds. I was allergic to the outdoor Northwest. But the therapy that I am now doing is getting my immune system back into balance by limiting the foods I'm sensitive to, taking these clear drops of antigens below my tongue. And I now have 80% recovered in my right ear. I can hear birds, I can hear insects, I can hear many of the things that even the best ears hear. My left ear, however, is still only at 25%. The way I look at it now is my glass is half full. Now that my hearing is recovering, I have a deep appreciation for what it means not just to hear, but what it means to listen.
When you were unsure whether your hearing was going to come back, what was important for you to do while you still had some of your hearing left?
I had been working on my life's achievement, hopefully, in the future. This is Quiet Planet. Quiet Planet is where I'm bringing over 30 years of soundtracking around the globe into an organized library for industry. So that I wanted to get together. But honestly, most of my day was spent doing this. Just rubbing my fingers together and giving myself a hearing test on my right ear and on my left ear. And even now, I can do that. And some simple tests like that, I can measure the improvement that I'm making. So now let me describe to you what I hear when I do this. On my right ear, oh, it's really nice. I like that a lot, because it shows that there's some grip to my fingers. It skids along, and there's not only the g-g-g-g-g, but there's nice bright going along with it. That's like epic. To me, that's like totally epic.
What's epic about it? Just the fact that you can hear the subtleties?
Oh, just that I can hear it at all. The epic thing is that I have detail back in my life. Before that, I wouldn't even be able to hear anything but an indicator sound that I knew something was happening, but what was happening, I couldn't tell. And on my left side, the only thing that I wouldn't be able to hear anything on my left side when I rub my fingers together. The only thing I'd be able to hear is if I tapped my head. Well, now on my left side, I really like this because I told you earlier that I only have 25% recovery in my left ear, but I don't believe that that's true right now, because I'm also getting a little gripping. See, these are the baby steps towards progress that I make that really make my day and get me excited. Oh, it's like wonderful. I'm encouraged. I think they'll come back. Yeah, I think they'll come back. So I'm going to keep up everything I'm doing and hang in there. It's been 2.5 years so far in the recovery process. And I thought I might have 2 more years, but based on what I'm hearing today, I'll give it possibly within 2015, I'll be 100%. And that's when you'll see me buying some tickets online to go to the next great place to record.
Gordon Hempton, the soundtracker, lives on the Kitsap Peninsula, and he continues to work on his magnum opus, Quiet Planet. Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and do you remember when this was happening?
After 2 years on the run, the so-called Barefoot Bandit accused of robbing people in 8 states.
It's bizarre to be true what's happened the past 2 years here. And now it ends in typically high Hollywood style with a short, high-speed boat chase.
And you believe the most wanted teenage fugitive in America is behind bars, taken into custody, caught.
So after a chase that went on for 2 years, the authorities finally captured Colton Harris Moore, also known as the Barefoot Bandit. This teen had become infamous for this cross-country crime spree. You know, he had broken into homes, he had stolen boats and cars and bicycles and airplanes. He actually stole airplanes. And so in the summer of 2010, he was caught and later convicted and is currently serving a sentence at the Stafford Creek Correction Center in Aberdeen. And for the last few years, he's had a regular visitor there, Jonathan Standridge. Standridge had mentored people before, and he met somebody that knew somebody, and then one strange night, he found himself talking to somebody close to Colton. You see, Standridge works for a certain large aerospace company based here in the Northwest, and he and Colton have this shared love for airplanes. And so they wrote a few letters back and forth, and then Jonathan drove out to meet him.
It was almost comical. I got there. I'd never been to a prison before. So I walked into the prison, went through the process, got into a large room that looked like a large cafeteria, He eventually came through the door, a sunburn. He had been out in the yard. I stood up. We introduced ourselves. And when we sat down, we started having just some general conversations.
Did you connect right away, or was there a moment of, you know, eyeing each other a little bit more warily? I mean,
there was a lot of eyeing.
Yeah.
Okay. And rightfully so. Colton has a lot of people trying to get next to him. We were within the first 15 or 20 minutes, and I could tell by his body language, he was really trying to figure out who I was. And so I threw it out on a table, and I asked Colton, I go, "You're probably wondering why I am here, aren't you?" And he laughed pretty easy and says, "Yes, well, the thought had crossed my mind." And I go, "Let me tell you a story." And the story goes back to my youth. And when I was a young guy, I joined the Navy. I joined the Navy because I had no other place to go. I had about 10 years of alcohol and drug abuse. I went through basically detox and Navy boot camp. First day in boot camp, you're giving a urinalysis, which I failed with flying colors. And I was giving it everything I knew. I knew this was my last stop in life. If I failed this, then I was done. And my company commander and my division officer saw that. So I had to go all the way through boot camp. I finally got through detox, I think about the fifth week, and life started coming together, and I was starting to think clearer again. And the last day of boot camp, I got sent to something called Captain's Mass. It's a place you don't want to go. And it's obvious I am guilty. And the skipper said, "Mr. Standridge, out of every 100 people who come up in front of me, I generally give 2 people a second chance." He goes, "I am giving you one of those chances. I am going to follow your career. Do not disappoint me." Everything I ever did in the Navy, and from that point forward, has been about, would that Navy captain agree that the second chance he gave me, would it have been worth it? That's the story I told Colton. What I'm asking of you is what I give you, then you, sometime in the future, once you get established, you have to promise me you will pass that on to at least one person. And he got very excited about that. We shook hands, we had some fun, and we've been building a strong relationship ever since.
Wow. So after you establish that and he can kind of understand what you're doing there and what mm-hmm. the expectations are, then you actually have to have a relationship of some kind, right? So how did you build that? Like, what was it built on? What were the things that you connected over?
Anything that has to do with airplanes or flight or manufacturing. Colton's greatest passion is one day he will design and build his own airplane. The last conversation we had just a few weeks ago centered around the human factor in the manufacturing process.
What do you think that he is getting out of the interaction with you? What's he getting out of this relationship?
You know, one of the promises I made Colton is I would never speak for him. So I will only go so far as to say friendship. We have actually developed a very nice friendship, and we don't always agree. They can be impassioned discussions, but at the end of the day, I'm just going to leave it at friendship.
Colton Harris Moore is kind of a larger-than-life figure for people who know him only from the media, mm-hmm. right? And they know the myth around him.
Yes.
What can you tell us about him that you have seen or heard or experienced that can convey a little bit about the person that you know?
What the media and these documentary films have made this young man out to be has missed the target by such a huge degree. He is highly motivated, a caring individual who is ready to take his life and move forward in ways that will be inspiring to many people. But he's easy to smile, a relaxed manner, but when we talk business, it can be a very intense and focused discussion. But this is a young man who's ready to move forward.
So what, I mean, you've named a few things already, but what do you think is the biggest thing that the public portrayal of him misses?
You get the feel there's a lot played on the criminal element. But again, there were parts of his life that drove that behavior that were out of his control.
There's also the fact that he was almost a child still, right? I mean, he was so young.
Oh, and he was a child when the lifestyle started. We've almost as a society, whether the school system, the justice system, we almost created who he became. That's why I'm so for second chances.
Where is Colton now? Which prison is he?
Aberdeen.
Aberdeen, okay.
Yes.
So, and you drive there from SeaTac?
Yes.
So that's what, like a couple?
Couple hours.
Couple hours, and you do it once a month?
Minimum once a month, yes.
Getting a second chance, having a life after being incarcerated is difficult for anybody. And he has the extra challenge, it seems, of having this big, larger-than-life public figure. And I wonder if you've done anything to try and prepare him for that, or how you imagine that's going to be to confront once he gets out.
Well, we do have some pretty plain-speaking conversations once in a while. But the greatest revenge, if you want to use the word revenge, is just living a good, boring life. and when we joke about that, and that's what it's about. He's not coming out to the spotlight or for the spotlight. He wants to move on with his life, getting out, going to school, starting a business, and living such a boring life nobody wants to follow him anymore.
Well, Jonathan Standridge is a project manager for a large aerospace company here in the Northwest, and has been for the last couple of years a mentor to Colton Harris Moore. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
You're welcome, and thank you for inviting me. Appreciate it.
From redemption for a young man to second chances for objects now, we're going to take you shopping at Goodwill. Okay, so far so good, but now imagine 900 people lined up first thing in the morning, waiting for the doors to open of a thrift store. This is the annual glitter sale. So over the course of the year, all the Goodwill locations around Puget Sound hang on to the rarest and best vintage used items, and they hold them for this two-day sale in one location. The proceeds go to job training and education programs for low-income people. KPLU's Kevin Kniestad showed up there bright and early to talk to some of the shoppers. And first, he met up with Catherine Bowery. She's communications manager for Goodwill.
We typically get people that camp out the night before, so this year is no different. We had a number of people that get here about 8:30, 8:45, some midnight. A lot of people do that.
So what are your names?
Sherry King.
And Ben King. We got here right just before 9. So.
We had a tent. The only thing that was bad is that around 3 o'clock there was a crowd that came in, and they were kind of loud and giggly, and they woke us up, but it was fine.
We didn't want to deal with any drama at the back of the line, and we knew if we were just 100 people back, we'd be jumpy about, let's get the line moving. So it just seemed easier to do. So.
And it would drive me crazy knowing that people were in there buying things that I might want.
My name's Nathan.
Cool.
Having, we spend all year going to Goodwill looking for treasures. You do find some hidden treasures and everything, but this is all treasure. It's like guaranteed gonna find cool stuff. And so, yeah, it's definitely worth getting up extra early.
An hour before the store opens, I would say we probably got maybe close to 1,000 people.
So what are your names?
Dana Presley. I expected to see a lot of tents and campers, but I didn't see that many. So we're definitely excited that it's not as bad as
we thought. You don't even have to stay here. You just get your wristband and leave.
In years past, we typically have seen about 3,000 people come and shop the sale. We're lucky we have a lot of return customers. They shop previous years. I've talked to people that have come over as far away from Taiwan, or flight attendants that annually come up from California for this trip. This is like a regular thing for people.
So what's your name?
Christopher. From L.A. We got here at 2:40 this morning, and I'm number 57. I do it every... I used to live in Seattle, and I've flown up for 4 years now since I'm down in California. I have found many... I have a collection of probably like 20 real Burberry scarves, cashmere scarves, all from the glitter sale, and like... You can find some pretty, pretty high-end things.
And what's your name? Chinchilla Von Schwamp. I actually built my costume, and it is based on a costume from Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. So it is a halter top jumpsuit made out of foil dot hologram gold fabric with giant feet that are about the 1.5 inches or 1.5 feet in diameter attached to the bottom of my feet, so I look like a duck-billed platypus. And then a nice little shrug to go with it with lots of flounces, and then this modest giant feather headdress. What I usually will find in a place like this is pieces that I can then take apart and rebuild and incorporate pieces of it into my own designs. You know, the other thing that I really like is that my dollar's going to make a difference in this community.
Well, what's your name?
Heather. I came last year for the first time. I love the vintage. I love that it's one of a kind. I love that it's stuff that you could never get at Nordstrom's or anywhere else. And, you know, you spend more money for something that's less unique and more cookie cutter. And here you get these really unique, amazing things.
When the doors open on a Saturday, we usually see people coming in as quickly as they can.
What's your name?
Rachel. I just started like the normal dress section. I'm just through white right now. There was something last year. It was like this sweater, but it was covered in like Barbie heads. I don't know how it made it in here entirely, but I think it was supposed to be like some kind of designer thing. And I mean, I appreciate it for its designerness, but I mean, Barbie heads on a sweater. That's not, I mean, I'm not gonna wear that out anywhere. So yeah.
My name is Julia. I just wanted to find some high quality stuff and give back to the community. I really like old style Coach purses. So I found quite a few of those, and I found some real fur jackets and shrugs. So I'm pretty excited about that.
What's your name?
Michelle Berg. This is my third year. I come with my mom and we just shop our hearts out. So you kind of have to pick your battles, like what category you're going to go after. Usually for me, it's coats. I love coats. But if it's a shoe thing or a bag thing or dresses, but it's hard to try to cover everything.
My name's Eric. I'm the husband and I'm guarding her stash here. I think this is our fourth year. Yeah, and she's a speed shopper. I think she goes in, hits the bags, grabs anything she'd be interested in, same with the shoes, and then parks them for later and tries them on afterwards. Yeah. Every now and then I'll pick up a jacket or something like that, but it's mainly about the wife.
My name is Quasi. At this point, I've got two almost floor-length fur jackets, this nice purple one I'm wearing in a nice, almost real-looking color. I've got a full sequin vest that is going to be absolutely amazing for some of the burlesque that I'm excited to do with it, and a faux sequin vest that's shiny and incredible. A lot of the time you hear about a thing and you go, there's no way this is going to meet the hype. This is so much more incredible finds than I would have ever expected.
I think that's what, you know, it's part of the treasure hunting aspect of it. You can come find something that nobody else has. I mean, I think this is an annual event, so people, you know, look forward to it. You know, they're there with their friends, and so I think it is kind of like a celebration.
Sound Effect is produced by senior producer Arwen Nix and by Kevin Kniestad, who braved the Goodwill parking lot for us. We had help this week from Ed Ronco and Art Teal. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer, and our online managing editor is Martha Kang. There are things, such as audio and pictures and links, at kplusoundeffect.org. You can tell us what you think of the show by tweeting at KPLU or write to soundeffect@kplu.org. And hey, Sound Effect is now available as a podcast on iTunes. So go there and lap it up with your ears and leave us a review if you like it. We will be back next week with some big stories about tiny things.
The microbes have been here for so long. They have a lot to teach us.
This is a microbial world. It is, in all likelihood, a microbial universe, too.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.